Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-errands pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at NerdWallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter.
There's nothing better than feeling comfortable in your own shoes. And that doesn't mean flopping down on the couch with bunny slippers. Maybe you're a parent raising a little rock star, or a tech nomad working from anywhere and jumping from one thing to the next. Whoever you are, Allbirds wants you to be comfortable in your actual shoes too. Their wool runners, pipers, and loungers are designed for a level of coziness that makes you feel like you can do anything. You might even forget you're wearing them. And their shoes are so stylish, they go perfectly with a wear-whatever-I-want attitude. Allbirds is all about loving Mother Nature, too, because no one wants to leave a bad footprint. Each shoe is carefully crafted from natural materials that tread lightly on our planet. From ZQ-certified merino wool to a bouncy midsole made from sweet foam, the world's first carbon-negative EVA material made from sugarcane. So get comfortable in your shoes. Get to know the wool runners, pipers, and loungers at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Hello, and welcome to Unexplained Extra, or this special edition of Unexplained Extra, I should say, with me, Richard McLean Smith. So this week, as you may be aware, I announced that I would do a one-off sort of question and answer episode to coincide with the upcoming release of the book Unexplained. In light of that announcement, I had a number of people asking me what were the books that had inspired me or the show. So I just thought, rather than putting up a list on social media, why not just talk about them? And I've been overwhelmed with the response. So thank you all so much for getting in touch and giving me your questions. I've managed to condense it down to about 15 or so, I think. Apologies if I haven't included yours on the show. So just a couple of quick, easy ones to start off with. A few people had asked me about the music. So the music in the show, I composed that myself, and you can hear quite a large part of it on the Unexplained SoundCloud. So if you wanted to hear that, you could go to soundcloud.com/unexplainedpodcast, I think is the address, and you can find it there. And the other question that quite a few of you were asking was, is the book going to be an audiobook as well, and will I be narrating it? And the answer to that is yes, it will be. And so at the moment, the book is due out in the UK October the 25th, and we are sort of talking about getting it distributed in the US and Canada as well. So I think just watch this space on that one. So let's begin. I had quite a few questions in a similar vein to this one, so I'll just take one, which is from Conan, who asks, have you ever had a personal supernatural experience? So the short answer to that is no, but something that I might talk about in more depth later on in another question is that I suppose you could also say that maybe I have, but I wasn't aware that it was supernatural. But I think what I do find fascinating, though, is that I have heard from lots of people and from people that I would consider to be perfectly rational and intelligent people who claim that they have seen things that I might have previously dismissed. So I suppose that just leaves me wondering what it was exactly that was seen or what was experienced. So next one is from Lee Britton. Have you had an opportunity to meet with anyone directly involved with any of the events that you've mentioned? If so, who was the most convincing? I have, actually. I haven't in person. I have over the phone or on Skype or email. I've spoken to people that have been at the centre of some of these stories, and I mean, they've all been convincing. I mean, and in fact, the sort of thread that runs through them all really was that none of them were absolutely convinced that what had been experienced was supernatural or paranormal, but I'd say they had an interest in that as a potential or a possibility. In the main, I guess, I don't think they were making up what they think they experienced, if that makes sense. So the next question, again, this is one that I had quite a few questions in a sort of that were similar in one way or another. So let's just take Steve. Steve asks, of all the podcasts you have researched, which have you found the most disturbing and which is the most scariest? So this is a difficult one. The ones that were disturbing and scary, I think I would have to say, are the ones that involved the most sort of traumatic outcomes or events. So a lot of the time these stories, as terrifying as they might be, they don't result in somebody dying or being killed, and except for one which I told in the first season, which was about, as you might know, it's called Demons in Suburbia, which was a story about a man called Michael Taylor who had quite tragically and traumatically been affected in one way or another by an exorcism that was practiced on him, and the consequence of that was that he murdered his wife in quite horrific circumstances. So I don't have much more to say on that because I'm not so familiar with the case and life of Michael Taylor that I would be able to comment possibly about the reasons and whys and wherefores of what happened. But that was certainly the one that I think as a story alone was the most disturbing. Okay, so not particularly related to the last few questions, but let's do the first book anyhow. So this book's been a huge influence on me, I think, not just for the show, not for the way I write, or but the way I certainly would like to write or aspire to write. It's a book that was recommended to me quite a while ago as a sort of, it was recommended as a travel book, but I think the intention wasn't to reduce it in such a way, but that's how I remember it anyhow. And so when I read it, it opened up into so many other things that I hadn't been expecting. So the book is called The Rings of Saturn. It's by W.G. Sibbald. Superficially, the book presents as an account of one man's journey through Suffolk, the Suffolk coast, particularly in East Anglia in the United Kingdom. But quite quickly, it becomes apparent that there's quite a bit more going on. So you find yourself being taken on this extraordinary, very melancholic journey into the workings of Sibbald's mind. I think the way he sort of touches upon the things that the landscape inspires in him and in his sort of ruminations and his thoughts as he's making this journey. And from that, you get sort of taken on this extraordinary sort of epic trip through lots of different waypoints and connections that are being triggered as he's making his way through the countryside. And it's become quite a sort of major touchstone, I think, of modern psychogeographic writing. So, I mean, I'm sure there are lots of different opinions on this out there as to the, you know, the quality of it in comparison to other books. But I would say that it's certainly become one of the better known sort of examples of this sort of writing. Just the expanse of information alone that throughout the book is quite extraordinary. It's a sort of domino effect. He has a sort of way of exploding information from one thing, connecting from one thing to the next. And actually, a very sort of brief note, I would say at one point he talks about Joseph Conrad being in Lowestoft, I think, and he draws a connection there between that as the beginning of a journey that's end point was essentially the horrors of colonialism. And so another book I would say, just sort of very briefly recommend, that has been quite a big inspiration on me and in some ways unexplained, is Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And so with this book, I think what I've drawn from it in terms of unexplained is just a sort of the sense of the horror of humanity, really, and what what human beings are capable of. And I'm not quite sure this is explored in the book, but the sort of idea that human beings don't perpetrate evil acts, that there's no such thing as evil in that respect. I mean that humanity is all of it. So for me personally, I don't think there's a moral arbiter that dictates what is and what isn't evil. There's no, you know, nobody is making that judgment on our behalf. We do that ourselves. Of course, we can, as a society, decide together which things we determine to be wrong or bad or unpalatable or criminal. And as a sort of slight extension to that point, I think certainly the kind of setting and the locations and many of the things that are occurring in Heart of Darkness are based on true stories and true things that happened. And I think the sort of ultimate true horror really is that, and I think I tend to find this quite often, is that the reality of the stories, if you read the actual stories about what took place under King Leopold II of Belgium, who was sort of spearheading this colonial campaign, the fact is you find that it's almost impossible to come up with the reality of the terrible things that were happened, you know, that the real story is even worse. So let's try and come back a bit from that, because I think, I don't know, I can take that any darker. So let's get back to questions, I think. You're starting to get a sense now of where Unexplained comes from. So this is a message from Elizabeth. So what determines what catches your interest? Is it mostly what intrigues you, or more about how easy you find to communicate the story? Well, I think what catches my interest first and foremost, especially because of the nature of the show and it being, you know, based on ideas that are unexplained and remain to this day unexplained, the key thing is having a story that's not too easy to debunk, I suppose, or having a story that's not that doesn't present itself too obviously as being a hoax. So I suppose the best stories for me are the ones that sort of really stretch that suspension of disbelief as far as possible. So sometimes I find that will supersede whether I personally am into that kind of story. And as well, a lot of the time I find that digging a bit deeper into the story, it will sort of reveal itself to be actually more interesting and more fascinating than I had first imagined. Okay, I've got quite a few questions here about how I got involved in doing this and what I was before Unexplained and all that sort of stuff. So without giving too much away, I don't want to destroy the illusion completely, but I have, I think for quite some time, been trying to write and, you know, get somewhere doing that. And it's a case really of just discovering an outlet where I could write something and it actually becomes something. A lot of the time, you know, if you're writing any form of writing, really, you're trying to get through some kind of gateway to get into something that legitimizes what you're doing and also gets what you're doing out there. So whether it's to be published or to have an article printed in a magazine or to have a TV show commissioned or something like that, you know, if you're very lucky. And so those things take time and they take a lot of effort and they require you to be, you're at the whim of somebody else's taste. And I think, so Unexplained really started as a combination of having that ambition, but also the fascination with these stories and not being quite sure what to do with them. And then discovering the podcast and what the podcast was. And it's, you know, I think that's something we're a lot more familiar with now, but a few years ago, you know, it sort of, I didn't really understand it in the way that I do now. And I could craft it myself and put it up myself and all that sort of stuff. The show was kind of born in it and it evolved a bit in the process of, you know, understanding what a podcast can be and all that sort of stuff. And I've been completely overwhelmed by the fact that anybody listened to it at all. So, I mean, this is a great chance to thank you all again. Anybody who listens to the show has supported the show for the incredible kind words and, you know, and the encouragement that I've been given. Yeah, it's been extraordinary. And just to finish that point off, Ruhao asks, or Ruhao says, I'm presuming you do it all in a dark wood-paneled book-lined room, sitting in a leather armchair with a pipe and a bottle of single malt. And the answer is yes, of course. That's exactly how I do it. Rue also asks, is the cover picture a reference to Twin Peaks? I think in many ways, you could probably say everything I do is a reference to Twin Peaks. So although that wasn't, I actually wasn't thinking of Twin Peaks when I chose it. But yes, of course, I mean, subconsciously, absolutely, it's probably where I've found that, I've got that idea from. So Christopher asks, my question is, do you have trouble sleeping at night or going about your daily life having made podcasts on such otherworldly material? So I would say yes. So yes, I do. I do, because I am always thinking about the story or the next story, and invariably, because of the subject matter, it becomes, it's very easy for your imagination to run wild. So on that note, and I think this is a more seamless transition to the next book. So the next book that has inspired me and Unexplained is actually a collection of stories, but primarily the one called Don't Look Now, which I'm sure many of you will be familiar with, the Daphne du Maurier short story, which was later made into a brilliant film by Nicholas Roeg. And so this really inspires me. And there's another book as well I will talk about sort of in tandem with this one, which is Joan Lindsay's Picnic at Hanging Rock. So there are lots of reasons why I love both these books, but I suppose we could start with tone. So this is something I think I've probably quite deliberately in one way or another tried to replicate in Unexplained, which is to create the idea or the sort of sense of a world that's familiar and real and genuine and kind of scrutable, but then have this air of something else, the possibility of something else, something more enigmatic and sort of intangible and, you know, magical in a way, I think, you know, whether that be spooky or terrifying magic or not. And I think more than any other book that I've certainly read, both these stories do that in incredible ways. And I think Picnic at Hanging Rock is probably more enigmatic, since it's so essentially, if you're not familiar with the story, it was set, I think, in 1900, or is it on Valentine's Day in 1900. Some girls from a school are taken on a trip through the outback in Australia, in Victoria, I think, in the state of Victoria in Australia, to this sort of strange natural landmark known as Hanging Rock, which I've actually been to, and it is just as sort of special as it sort of portrayed in the book. But so anyway, a couple of these schoolgirls go missing, and as well as their teacher, I think, I might have that wrong, but they go missing and there's no explanation. And I can't tell you much more, I don't want to give anything away, but it's incredibly mysterious, beautifully portrayed story, and very sort of hypnotic. That, of course, goes into all sorts of other things about sort of adolescent awakening and all sorts of things like that. So thoroughly recommended anyway, whether you like ghost stories or not. It's not actually imperative to enjoying the story. So with Don't Look Now, it's a sort of similar thing, but I think there's more of the sort of supernatural paranormal stuff going on, which is particularly compelling because it's done in this way where it's not sort of hysterical and so strange that it's off-putting or distracting. It's sort of du Maurier and sort of merges them into the world that we think we know in such a way that I don't think has been bettered, actually. So yeah, read those books. So back to the questions. I had a couple quite similar from Malcolm and Tom, who ask, do you have your own conclusions to the stories you research? And Tom asks, are there any that you truly believe have answers that lie beyond known science? So these are good questions, actually, in relation to the nature of the show and, you know, my kind of thinking behind putting it together. And that really is that, I know this might sound strange, but I don't, going back to Malcolm's question, do I have my own conclusions to the stories? I actually don't dwell on that too much. I think what makes them interesting is that they are these sort of open mysteries and unanswered questions that then in turn invite new questions. And, you know, I think when you allow these stories to just sort of be rather than try and interrogate them too much, I think that is where they sort of come most alive and provoke the most sort of interesting discussion. And I think this is something I've tried to do as well that I hope comes across, which is that it's not, that doesn't mean that the story has to be the ghost wasn't real or it wasn't really a poltergeist or whatever, and that that's the end of the story. You know, that if we were able to conclude once and for all that no, this didn't happen and this is actually what happened, and you have that sort of full fact laid out in front of you. I think even if that were the case, I don't think that would be the end of the story. I often say that I think even if it were to be proven once and for all that God didn't exist, I think people would still believe in it or believe in her or him or however way you hold the divine. And I think that in itself is sort of equally as fascinating as to whether there's a definitive answer or not. It kind of draws me on to my next question, which is from M, who talks about how I sometimes use the mysterious and the 14 as a lens to explore deeper historical and sociological themes. And is there any other literature that you are drawing on that specifically looks into the sociology of fear about the mysterious and the paranormal? So I don't specifically, but that would be certainly be a very interesting thing to look at. How people's fears were maybe not manipulated, but were sort of concentrated around specific ideas of the time or things that have happened in the time. And certainly today you can see the ways in which people's fears are stoked and manipulated by the media. And so one very good documentary you can watch all about that is called The Power of Nightmares by Adam Curtis, which I thoroughly recommend if you want to learn a bit more about that. So the next book is Straw Dogs by the philosopher John Gray. Not the same John Gray who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, a very different John Gray, and not the film. This is not the film Straw Dogs. So this is an entire thing on its own, Straw Dogs by John Gray, and the subtitle is Thoughts on Humans and Other Animals. And I think when I read this book, it was the first time I sort of really started to understand and look a bit more broadly on the human race and what it is to be human and sort of picking apart the delusion that we have about who we are and our sort of deluded sense of separateness from the natural world and the way we sort of position ourselves apart from other animals. In fact, frequently you will often hear people talk about humans and animals almost as if we're not part of that group. So it goes into, I mean, there's a lot more, way more than I can sort of expound on here, but I would, yes, just thoroughly recommend it. It's well worth reading. I think it's a complicated point about whether we need to be more aware of the damage we do because of the delusions that we have as human beings. I mean, you could also argue that instead of being deluded, that is also a natural sort of form of existence in a way, but it certainly doesn't hurt to kind of think more broadly about that and what that means and what that means for the way that we think of ourselves and think of others as well. So next question is from Daniel. What advice would you give to other creative types who want to create cool stuff like you? Well, thank you, first of all, for calling Unexplained Cool. That's very kind. But also I would just say as well that I think everybody is creative. Everybody is a creative type. We all in our own ways can be creative or find ways to be creative. But that being said, of course, I think I know what you mean. So I would say, obviously it depends on what it is you're trying to create. But if we're talking about writing, for example, and of course Unexplained is a podcast, but really what it's based on is writing and storytelling and having a sense of how to engage an audience. I don't know to what degree I'm especially successful at doing that or not, but I think if I've learned anything really, it's understanding structure and the structure of storytelling. And I think when I was starting out, when I was much younger, and I had ambitions of writing and aspirations of doing all sorts of things with that, I didn't really understand why it was important in the way that I do now, which is really that it's not that you need to follow rules and you need to kind of adopt certain techniques. It's just more that having an understanding of them gives you such a head start in terms of approaching a blank page, which is, as most people who write, I imagine, will tell you, is the kind of the worst bit, is that initial getting something down and having something to work with. And so I think just understanding structure and how to tell a story and reading up on that sort of thing can be really, really beneficial. And of course, once you know it and you understand why certain things work the way they do, then you can play around with it and you can dismiss it out of hand. I think that, I mean, that's basically the point, is that it's better to know something and ignore it than to not be aware of it. I think in this sense, not always the case, absolutely not always the case, but from my experience anyway, I think that has been helpful. And to that end, I will recommend a couple of books that I think as a writer really helped me. So one is Wired for Story by Lisa Kron, which is really just an introduction into how to kind of hook a reader into your story. And it's just very sort of clear. It's very, very clear and easy to read. And again, it's things you can sort of take or discard at your own sort of discretion. And in a similar vein, another book that I found quite useful was Writing the TV Drama Series by Pamela Douglas. And as you can tell from the title, obviously this is specifically for TV drama, but I think a lot of the same rules apply to whatever kind of narrative writing you are trying to do, if that's what you're trying to do. And lastly, just quickly, another book that really helped me starting out was a book called How to Write a Novel by the author John Brain, who is most well known for a book he wrote called Room at the Top. And so again, you might not be wanting to write a novel specifically, but it just has a lot of kind of really great lessons and ideas about how to get started and how to really just start tackling the thing that you're trying to do. And it is a big, you know, writing anything is difficult, so it mainly requires practice. And the other thing, of course, is just reading and watching and listening to as much as you can and sort of taking that in and trying to absorb it. So on to the next questions. So Samantha asks, do you believe in the existence of beings not in our realm? In light of your extensive research over the past years in putting together Unexplained Podcast and your new book, have you been swayed one way or another in this belief? So I think this goes back a little bit to the earlier questions about what conclusions I've drawn myself from some of these stories. And I think the key word here is believe. So, you know, it's something that comes up particularly with supernatural, paranormal you know, just stories in general of that kind, which is the sort of notion of belief and what you believe in and what you believe is possible. So I think for me, there was a quote, and I can't remember who said it, it was to do with having seen a particular supposed paranormal event, and their response was that, I didn't say it was possible, I said it happened. And I think that's really the approach I take to the stories, which is that I have no reason to disbelieve the anecdotal evidence that is being presented. So I take it at face value, and you know, that might be silly or gullible or ignorant, but the point is really that is to display the things as they occurred, or as we're sort of led to believe they occurred, without interrogating that too much. But going back to the question, so about belief, well, really the thing is that I don't think I have seen or come across anything that would convince me of a paranormal or supernatural thing being real, actually having taken place. But, you know, equally haven't seen anything that can say once and for all that it hasn't either. So within that, you know, I couldn't possibly commit to something being real until there was evidence enough for that to be a certainty. And of course, the thing is, in actual life, the things that we consider to be real and absolutely true, you know, it's rare to find that sort of certainty too. If you start interrogating things, if you start to get a bit closer and down and dirty with things, you find that the things that we do think are true and real aren't in fact as true and real as we might think they are, which is also, I think, a big sort of theme of the show. So Jeff asks, were there any potential episodes that you nixed because the subject matter creeped you out too much? So no, absolutely not. I think the creepier the better, I would say. Which brings me to my next book recommendation, or rather book that has inspired Unexplained. So this is a writer that will be familiar to many people who listen to the show. This is H.P. Lovecraft. Lovecraft is a complicated writer to sort of admire, ostensibly because I think it's quite well documented that he was quite racist, and he had a sort of fear of, I think, well, he was anti-Semitic, and also... but had a particularly repugnant sort of attitude towards anybody who wasn't white, and I think primarily to Americans who were black. So why that becomes particularly complicated in terms of his stories is that fear that he had of this otherness, of what he perceived to be this otherness, as what I would say, as ignorant and appalling as that was, that it was that fear that he used that that was obviously very visceral to him, that was then sort of imbued in the text and the language that he used in his sort of horror stories. So in many ways, the reason why they're so compelling is because that fear was so real to him. And so, of course, that makes it incredibly odd and complicated and strange when you're reading these stories, sort of knowing that that fear is the foundation on which these stories are built and constructed. You know, that is a complicated thing. That is a complicated thing to kind of hold that at the same time. But separating the story from that, what remains are incredibly gripping, horrifying stories. And they're particularly horrifying because you can sort of feel that sense of terror. Personally, I find some of his writing quite dense, and it can feel sometimes a bit of a trawl to get through. But always within it, there's this sort of extraordinary imagination of other worlds that are created. And what I find most compelling about it is that unlike lots of other stories of this kind of ilk, where you're encouraged ultimately to think that there was some kind of psychological catalyst that was provoking these stories, but with Lovecraft, a lot of the time it's actually, you know, you're invited to think that the horror is real. It's not imaginary, that these creatures, you know, are existing in their own sort of autonomous way, whether they be in another realm or under the sea, sort of subterranean things. And so that I find that particularly compelling. I mean, the book I have in front of me at the moment is a collection of his stories. This is Lovecraft, The Call of Cthulhu, or Cthulhu, a few different ideas on how to say that, and other weird stories. And if I had to pick one, for any of you who haven't read him before, let's go for The Shadow Over Innsmouth. This is actually one of his longer stories, but plot-wise and the revelation that you will discover on reading it, I think it's certainly, for me anyway, it's one of his best. We'll wrap this up with a couple more questions. Andrew asks, he says there's probably a lot of people asking this, but actually you are the only one. So thank you. It's a good question. If you could know the definitive answer to just one unexplained mystery, what would it be and why? So again, going back to the previous questions, I don't feel the need necessarily to know the answer, but I think the one I would most like to know would be the lighthouse keepers rather, from I think episode 8 of the first season, which was called When the Light Fades. I think, as some other people have asked me, what was my own personal favourite, I think that for me is my favourite one so far. And the reason why I'd like to know that is because I think anything that involves, you know, missing people, missing individuals, I think there's something inherently and obviously terribly tragic about that for anyone that's been left behind. And not knowing what has happened to a loved one that has disappeared, I think is you know, in some ways almost more horrific than finding out that they might have been killed. So Dietmar asks, what is the appeal of the unexplained in general for you especially? Is it even a good idea to concern oneself with stuff like that? Wouldn't it be healthier not to do that? Well, so I know where you're coming from in terms of, you know, I think if you're someone who might dismiss all these stories out of hand, then it seems a bit of a nonsense to even kind of give them the light of day or the darkness of night, as it were, or you know, to give them any sort of sense of credibility whatsoever. And I think, again, I think that, maybe going back to something I said earlier, I think that attitude has its own ignorance in a way. I think everything can have a potential worth. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be that we commit to the supernatural or paranormal explanation. But I think all these stories have something in them, you know, certainly from a human perspective. There are lots of things within these stories that can throw up all sorts of questions and ideas and things that go way sort of above and beyond and transcend the basic kind of question of whether these things really happened or what the actual explanation was, and whether that explanation is something beyond what we currently know or are aware of as being possible in our world or our reality. Which sort of brings me to my next book recommendation, which is Ways of Seeing by John Berger. John Berger was a, I think, primarily or professionally his sort of title, I suppose, was art critic, but he's much more than that. And he's written on lots of different subjects, but I think Ways of Seeing is probably what he was best known for. So this book, funnily enough, I won this when I was about 9 or 10 years old. I think I did. I'm a bit hazy on this, but I think I won this when I took part in something called the Spaghetti Bridge Building Competition, which is exactly as it sounds. When I was at school, I think our class got put forward for this, and the team I was in, myself and two others, we came third in a national competition. So I was very proud of myself, but I think really it might have had something to do with the fact that one of my team members' dads was an architect, and I think he might have helped plan the bridge. Anyway, we came third, and one of the things I won as a sort of 9 or 10 year old was this book, Ways of Seeing by John Berger, which I was far too young to appreciate at the time. I don't think I even read this till late teens, early 20s, but I'm glad I did, because basically, and there's a bit of a theme here, I suppose, developing with Unexplained in general, which is that what the book is really trying to teach you is that there are different ways to see the world, that there are many different perspectives. And I think it's something that's become just in mainstream, everyday kind of conversation. I think it's something we're becoming more aware of now and are interrogating more and more, this idea that there's not one way to hold the world, or that there's no, you know, there's not one version of history, there's not one version of the truth, I think more kind of potently. And so, yeah, this is a book really that kind of establishes that in a very sort of simplistic and powerful way, and, you know, by looking at art specifically and the ways in which we as individuals can sort of interpret the same piece of work in different ways, but also how the way that work is or art is interpreted differently throughout the years. So, for example, anybody looking at a painting that was made, you know, 400 years ago is not going to have the same context that you might have had you looked at it when it was first painted. And so the effect of that piece of art is kind of distorted in some way. So the effect of that painting, that piece of art that it has on the viewer is changed by not only the sort of context of the time that it's being observed, but also by what the viewer brings to the observation. So I think there's a quote, I can't remember again, I think it was Freud, although I don't know this for sure, but who said something like, you cannot analyze something without taking into account the mechanism through which it is observed. And I think it plays again into this sort of whole notion that you might hear sometimes people say sort of consciousness makes up the world. You know, I don't know the degree to which that might be true, absolutely. But I think, you know, there is an element of truth in that, certainly, that a lot of the time when what you are seeing in the world and the way that you respond to the world is not because of the truth of what that world is, but how you interpret that. So in that way, you kind of are making up the world. You know, for better or worse, you are kind of constructing the world in your head as much as the information from that world is being fed to you, if that makes sense. So just time for one final question, which is from Peter and Morgan, who ask, both of us are still dying to know why there is such an unexplained ghostly gap between McLean Smith in the phrase Richard McLean Smith. It is a very good question. I think it just came out like that, and I've sort of felt I had to stick to it ever since, but it's now kind of taken on a life of its own, where even if I try to close the gap, it feels like I'm sort of dishonoring the original version in some way. So I've tried to keep it quite consistent. I've also joked about how I think I should get a t-shirt made which just says Richard McLean on the front and then Smith on the back. I don't know if I'm quite narcissistic enough to do it. We'll see. So yeah, thank you so much for listening. Thank you even more for sending in your questions and for all your interest that you've shown in the show. Again, I can't thank you enough for all the support and kind words, and I hope you enjoy it going forward. As I mentioned before, I will put the list of books up on social media, so Twitter, Facebook, and I'll probably add a few more in there that I didn't think I had time to talk about this time around. Very, very difficult trying to compile a small list of books There have been so many that have inspired me, and also films and TV shows that have inspired me immensely, and music too. So maybe there are more lists to be made at a later date. Anyway, I think that's it for now. Once again, the book will be out on October 25th, and I'm actually going to be doing some live speaking events, which I'll be putting up on my website soon, if anyone's interested in coming along to that. Thank you very much again for listening to the show. I will be back next Tuesday with episode 8 of season 3. So until then. Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best. Speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video anytime between 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time, 7 days a week. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Tired of restless nights? At Leesa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Leesa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus 2 free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.
You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without the essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. I mean, it provides great protection and it's really breathable so you don't get hot. That's a win-win. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-errands pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.